believe, FINRA, and I rise to introduce to the court my co-counsel, Brad Bennett of Baker Botts in Washington, who is here with me today, although I will be presenting argument.
Welcome to the court.
Morning. May it please the court, Your Honor. Philip Traynor, Ashby and Geddes on behalf of Appellant American Stock Exchange. With me at counsel table, if I may present to the court, Martin Kaminsky and Ed McDermott, Pollock and Kaminsky, as well as Tony Ann Pladia of Ashby and Geddes. With the court's permission, Mr. Kaminsky will be presenting the argument on behalf of the appellate.
Certainly, welcome.
May it please the court, I'm Martin Kaminsky, representing the American Stock Exchange, which is the appellant here. There are two issues before the court. One has a subsidiary issue. The first issue is whether paragraph 4 of the agreement between the NASD and Mr. Sedano provides for one or two sources of indemnity and advancement. That has a sub-issue because the NASD has contended that we waived that argument below. The second issue is whether Article 5H of the NASD's charter creates a hierarchy of primary and secondary responsibility for advancement and, by extension, indemnity. Before I address each of the arguments, there is one development, factual development, that we want to bring to the attention of the court. In December of this past year, the Securities and Exchange Commission reversed the decision that had dismissed the claim against Mr. Sedano. So there is now an ongoing or potentially ongoing proceeding against Mr. Sedano. And if Your Honors wish to see that decision, it's reported at 2008 SEC Lexus 2845, December 22, 1908.
And that's relevant for us to know because it probably means he'll incur additional attorney's fees.
Correct, Your Honor. Turning to issue number one, which is the question of whether paragraph 4 of the agreement creates one or two sources of indemnity. As Your Honors know, I'm sure that really turns on whether the language that said to the fullest extent permissible under the law and the NASD organizational documents means that those two phrases around the and should be read together as one provision or whether there are actually alternatives or two different sources of indemnity. Before I go to the merits of that, let me address the question of waiver. The NASD has said that because that was not tried in the Chancery Court, that issue has been waived. As we explained in our briefs, that really is not the case. This was a trial only about advancement. The parties stipulated and the court ordered that the case would only be tried on advancement, that the American Stock Exchange's cross-claims and NASD's cross-claims would be reserved and deferred for further proceedings. That stipulation and order in the record at A1272, and at A1272 and 23, the nature of the proceeding is clearly laid out as an advancement proceeding, and thereafter at 1278 and 79, there's an express provision that our cross-claims are deferred.
Well, help me understand. I'm going to state this somewhat simplistically, but the argument in the brief seems to be that the matter proceeded arguably only focusing on advancement, but with the understanding that advancement and indemnification were linked and the answer to one was the answer to both. Is there any support in the record for the trial proceeding with that understanding that the answer to both was the same?
No, some of the issues bear on both, Your Honor. For example, the NASD says there's only one source of protection for Mr. Sedano, and that's how they want to read paragraph 4, and they say that that's the NASD's organizational documents, and they say that Your Honor should affirm the Vice Chancellor's decision that Article 5 creates a hierarchy, as I will refer to it, of primary and secondary responsibility, so that if you were to agree with them on all of those issues, that would dispose of the case as the Vice Chancellor did. We say that's not so, that we had reserved for further proceedings, the argument that was never advanced by Sedano, but is advanced by us, that article, that paragraph 4 of the contract actually creates alternative or separate, two separate indemnities, and that there's a contractual indemnity that the American Stock Exchange is entitled to show existed, and if that's so, then we're entitled to contribution. Sedano really relied, as we explained in the briefs, on the organizational documents. He was pretty confident that they protected him. Everyone was a little skittish about paragraph 4 in an advancement case because, notwithstanding the fact that the Vice Chancellor did rule that the language covered advancement, everyone was a little nervous because paragraph 4 of the contract never mentioned the word advancement, and those of us in the case were all aware of the authority in this court that in order to have advancement in Delaware, you're supposed to use that talismanic word, which had not been done. So Sedano was proceeding under the organizational documents. We, that is American Stock Exchange, had always intended to proceed in a broader way. If you look at Mr. Sedano's motion to bifurcate, which was made before the stipulation and the order, and that can be found, if I've got my notes correct here, at A572, you'll see that he was arguing that that Amex and NASD had complicated his very simple advancement case by putting in all these other issues, and he wanted the court to bifurcate the case and allow a very narrow trial on advancement under the NASD documents. And that's why it proceeded in that way. So we felt that there was no need to go into any of these other issues. We all reached that agreement that the court then so ordered about it. Other support for this point of view is that the minute the Vice Chancellor went so far as then to dismiss our cross-claims, which were supposed to be deferred, which only happened after the case was tried and at the very end of his opinion, then Mr. Sedano's counsel submitted an order that would coincide with the judge's decision. Our counsel, Mr. Ashby, wrote a letter and objected at that point and pointed out that these issues were supposed to be deferred and specifically called that to the attention of the Vice Chancellor. The Vice Chancellor disagreed and entered the order. Mr. Ashby's objection is at A1284. It's the second part of his letter. And in the letter, by the way, he acknowledges that, as I said before, if you were to agree with the NASD that there's only one source of indemnification and you agree with the Vice Chancellor about the hierarchy, then that ruling would dispose of the rest of the case. We've tried to convince you that you should not agree that there's only one source, and also that the Vice Chancellor's decision on the certificate is incorrect.
Well, you say one source, but as I understand the Vice Chancellor's ruling, he acknowledges there's two sources. It's simply his position that if your client goes first, you never get to the secondary source, whereas your argument is there are two sources and they're concurrent and simultaneous. So it's not a debate about whether there are two sources. The debate is whether they both have to respond initially and equally.
That's correct, Your Honor, except and I think that the Vice Chancellor saw that since he could rule and did rule, and we think correctly, that Mr. Sedano was entitled to advancement from both parties under the certificate. Nobody had to go beyond that. But the issue of the other source really was never raised because Sedano was really putting his case behind the organizational documents. But you're correct about what you're saying, Your Honor. And so I think if you look at Mr. Sedano's reply brief, you'll also see that he makes this very clear in footnote 2 in his reply brief. As we pointed out in our reply brief, that can be found at A1296 and 97. And in it, he expressly says, look, I'm not trying an indemnification case. I'm trying a very narrow advancement case under the NASD's organizational documents. That's all I'm trying. And he therefore distinguished a lot of the cases that had been cited against him by the NASD. And that, we think, is further evidence that these issues were being deferred, and everybody understood that when we went to the trial. Finally, on that point, on the point of waiver, the NASD has argued that we invited an error by this stipulation, or that somehow we caused this to happen, we being the American Stock Exchange. That's explained in the briefs in pretty much detail. All I'll say is that, as I pointed out a moment ago, the minute this question of a possible dismissal of the cross-claims came up, which was after the judge rendered his decision and the order was presented, the American Stock Exchange objected at that point with Mr. Ashby's letter and attempted to convince the court to remove that part of the final judgment and order. That's the first time we could have raised it, an objection, because it's the first time the matter ever came up. And if you think about this in its scope, if one were to say that that's not soon enough to object, then it means that the American Stock Exchange will never have a chance to object to the dismissal, because never had a chance to put in its case, and if they're not allowed to argue it here.
Well, I want to follow up on that last point. Help us sort this out procedurally. And one of your requests is that this go back to the Court of Chancery so you can put on your case. The Court of Chancery, in denying Mr. Ashby's motions for re-argument, for want of a better term, takes the position the two issues stand and fall together. I've decided one, I've decided the other, as a matter of law. The response that you're making in your briefs is that doesn't necessarily follow. We'd like to put on a case and tell you why it doesn't necessarily follow. So we have to come to grips with whether, as a matter of law, they stand and fall together, or there's something that would dictate a different result if you could present additional evidence. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And turning then to what, without trying to get this court to decide the ultimate question, we do think it should go back to the Chancery Court. There's a lot of evidence in the record, notwithstanding, that supports the view that there are actually two sources, and that Sedano was looking for very, very broad coverage, as much as he could possibly get. We've explained in some detail, and the Vice Chancellor's opinion goes through some of the history of what was happening at the Amex at that point. Sedano was terribly concerned about the financial condition of the Amex. He was concerned about the reaction of members to the way he was conducting the exchange and to the discussions that were going on to sell the exchange. There actually was a lawsuit brought against Sedano, Ryan, and many of the other directors, the directors of the American Stock Exchange, which, by the way, NASD paid for. They paid the defense of that case, which we think is inconsistent with the position they're taking here. All of this was going on, and the SEC started an investigation while this contract is being negotiated. And Sedano made very clear, and his counsel made clear, that he wanted every protection he could possibly get. He even went and spoke to the chairman of NASD to assure that that would be so.
Let me interrupt you, because I'm getting confused here. I thought we had all agreed that the trial court found that there were two sources of indemnification, and the only issue, if you will, was whether they were concurrent or hierarchical, to use your term.
We read the opinion by the trial court that way. NASD doesn't. They think that the trial court never made that determination. I think it's we would hope that the court would agree that there are the two sources, and that Sedano, and that the record fully supports the view that Sedano wanted every kind of source he could get. I hope I'm not going off the question, Judge Berger, but as you recall, he even wrote in the margin of one of these drafts that he wanted his protection under the Delaware law.
Okay, so you're saying that you think the court, the trial court, already gave you that one, but you want to make sure, and you're making that argument just in case?
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
And but your primary argument is that it ought to be joint and not hierarchical.
Well, then turning to the second part, yes. I mean, if we're correct that there are the two sources, then you really don't even have to get to the second argument for the moment. I mean, I think actually you do, but I mean, it's possible for Amex to get contribution without ever winning the second argument, so to speak. For example, let me explain that a little more clearly. If in fact there are the two sources of indemnity, one under the law as provided under the contract, and secondly, under the NASD organizational documents, then what's in Article 5th of the NASD organizational documents, we contend, doesn't even apply to the first question. That's a matter of contract and what the parties provided, and that's a separate contractual indemnity which would entitle us to contribution the same as occurred in the Chamison case and somewhat lesser circumstances in the Levy case. So that we think if we can go back and try that issue under the first source of indemnity, that then it's going to be a matter of the other defenses the NASD has raised, and they've raised some different defenses that never got before the trial court.
Well, help me, that we'll deal with. What I don't understand is you seem to be suggesting that if there are two sources, later you can make a case for contribution. But don't you have to prevail in this appeal? Because it seems that what the Vice Chancellor has said is that the NASD is secondary coverage, and that if the primary coverage responds, then the NASD doesn't have to respond at all, including doesn't have to contribute.
Let me quickly clarify that. If there are two sources, one is a contractual source. The NASD's certificate of incorporation doesn't mean anything for that source because that source is a separate contractual right in itself. The Vice Chancellor's decision was confined on the merits to the organizational documents, and the question was whether if the only source is under the organizational documents, that paragraph 5H trumps whatever rights were given under the organizational documents, but not under the contract. I don't have much time left, so I'll avoid 5H for the moment because I think we've briefed it in pretty much detail for the court. I'll say, rather than use up all my rebuttal time, if I may, I'll just turn to one or two things there. We do think, by the way, that this court, that the semantics that have been argued on both issues are really not controlling here. For example, on the first issue as to the contract, the word "and" can mean both an or. One can say you can recover under this and that. That means two things, and sometimes it means that you have a choice. The same thing under Article 5H, there's all this debate about the words "may collect," as we showed and as the Vice Chancellor himself noted, "may collect" may mean actually does collect, as we argue, so that it prevents double recovery, or it may be a permissive matter. So it really is an issue as to what is the context in which this case arose. And without saying too much more about Article 5H, because I'll save some time for rebuttal, we think that the better rule is not to declare some, by judicial fiat, some broadscape rule on a clause that has been in the jurisprudence for many, many years. There is not a single case that either side has found that has ever construed this clause the way that the NASD has. There's not a case on it. There are any number of situations that can arise where there's a subsidiary corporation or a non-subsidiary that someone sent to that has conditions that are not the same as for indemnity and advancement, that are not the same as in the company that sends someone there, and it's impossible to foresee all of those things at this time. We're asking that you give the words the simple meaning that they have to prevent a double recovery and not engender a lot of litigation. Because the real purpose of these provisions, as this court has said many times, is to make sure that directors and officers know that they're going to have these protections and not have to get embroiled in the kind of litigation that occurred here. We've argued the rest of our points on Article 58, so I'll save my minute at half.
All right.
Thank you very much.
May it please the Court. Before turning to the two arguments that the Amex has asserted on appeal, I just wanted to make clear to the Court two things about this appeal that I think are important to the context. One is, unlike so many of the advancement and indemnification cases that Your Honors hear up here, this is not a circumstance where someone is being prejudiced with respect to the underlying proceeding. Mr. Sedano has had all of his fees advanced and is going to continue to have his fees advanced. in the SEC proceeding which was brought. That's very much unlike the vast majority of the cases that Your Honors hear on that subject matter. The second point is to remind the court that the underlying SEC proceeding was brought against Mr. Sedano by reason of his service at the Amex. So it's his alleged conduct at the Amex which gave rise to the SEC proceeding here. There are two arguments that we have made in response to the Amex's argument. The first one is on the subject of whether Mr. Sedano, when he was negotiating the settlement agreement with the NASD, negotiated some separate, independent, contractual right to indemnification, and that this was a separate right, not limited by the organizational documents of the NASD. And as we explained in our briefs, first, it is the NASD's position that this argument was not preserved below. Now, we actually did not argue that it wasn't tried and therefore it was waived. Our argument was a little bit different than what the Amex's counsel said, and our argument is consistent with what's set forth in the briefs. The argument was that there came a time when there was an opportunity to be able to raise this question and it wasn't raised. And so, therefore, under Supreme Court Rule 8, unless the interests of justice so require, the court shouldn't hear the matter. And the four instances in which the Amex says it preserved the question below, if you look at those citations, and we discussed that in our brief, in none of those situations did they preserve the question. But then the Amex also said, well, the court ruled sua sponte and so precluded Amex from being heard on this question. So that satisfies the interests of justice test. So let me, if I may, just go through the chronology very briefly. Vice Chancellor Strein, after hearing the matter, rendered his opinion on July 15, 2008. And in the last paragraph of that opinion, he says, the NASD is secondarily liable for advancement and indemnification of Sedano's legal fees to the extent that Amex becomes unable to meet its obligation to provide advancement and indemnification to Sedano. Now, that opinion didn't have, it is so ordered at the end of it, it had a direction that Mr. Sedano should confer, his counsel should confer with other counsel, and within 10 days, submit a proposed form of order. And the counsel did confer and were unable to agree upon a proposed form of order. So on July 25th, and I mention the dates because there was a 10-day period, it wasn't as if in some expedited cases where one needs to submit a proposed form of order the same day. There was a 10-day period to really think about the implications of that last paragraph of the opinion. Amex's counsel wrote to the court, as did Mr. Sedano's counsel, and submitted competing forms, proposed forms of order. Now, the letter that Amex's counsel to the court sent to the court didn't say, Your Honor, you ruled on this indemnification without ever giving us a chance to argue about whether that settlement agreement conferred an independent right to indemnification, fullest extent permitted by law. And the letter also didn't say, Your Honor, you're wrong about your interpretation of the indemnification question. Instead, the letter goes beyond that and says that you know, they did say that they didn't think the form of order should include indemnification, but then the letter concludes by saying, again, we believe this is an appropriate boundary for the order, quote, even though we recognize that the court's logic in construing Mr. Sedano's advancement rights would seem to be on all fours with the relevant indemnification provisions when the time comes for an indemnification determination. The MX's brief suggests that that sentence talked just about the charter, but it didn't. It said the relevant indemnification provisions. And so, respectfully, it is FINRA's position that not only did Amex have an opportunity during that 10-day period to raise the arguments that it's raising now, but it didn't. And in fact, we submit that the error was invited because instead of saying to the court, you're wrong about your analysis, or you didn't give us a chance to be heard, they even went further and said it would seem to be on all fours in terms of the logic.
Is it correct that the Vice Chancellor's order, the one that you've discussed before the 10-day period for submitting formal forms of order, dismissed Amex's cross-claim against NASDAQ?
It did, Yes, the form of order did do that, Your Honor. Yes, that's correct.
Is this oversimplifying it, but doesn't that constitute a ruling on which they can appeal? The cross-claim didn't preserve the argument?
Your Honor, we're not saying that they hadn't asserted below arguments about indemnification. Our argument is they didn't tell His Honor when he was ruling on indemnification that they hadn't had a chance to be heard on the merits of it, and they also didn't tell him that his analysis was wrong, and that's the basis for what we're saying.
Okay.
So if the court then, using Rule 8, if you do end up choosing to rule on that, FINRA submits that it would be the plain error standard that would need to apply to obtain that reversal for the plaintiffs.
Well, Mr. Kaminsky seems to say they were surprised that the indemnification was decided, that they didn't think, they thought that would be postponed to a later day. Now, why should they not have been surprised?
Your Honor, I'm not able to address whether or not they should have been surprised. My argument is simply that once the Vice Chancellor did undertake to include that information in the final paragraph, they were then on notice and could have taken actions consistent with what they're now arguing, which FINRA submits is lawyer-created arguments that were thought of on appeal.
Your position is even if they had some reason to believe this would be postponed for a later day, once they got the opinion, they realized it hadn't been postponed, and during the 10-day that they had when they were working on the order, they should have said, we'd like to present additional evidence or testimony.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I may, there was a statement during the opening that a suggestion that Mr. Sedano's reply pretrial brief said that they weren't trying indemnification. In fact, the cited portion of Mr. Sedano's pretrial brief just simply said that they were acknowledging that indemnification to the fullest extent permitted by law did not include advancement.
So I take it from your preliminary statements that what you're saying consistent with your brief is that your client acknowledges that they kind of got Mr. Sedano involved with Amex, but that his current problems are a result of what he did with Amex, and it's appropriate that Amex pay his fees for what happened as a result of his conduct with them. Nevertheless, since your clients were responsible for getting him involved, to the extent Amex ever is at a point where it doesn't have the ability to pay the fees, you acknowledge that your client should come forward and pick them up.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly correct.
So your argument is that you acknowledge a secondary position, but not a co-primary position.
That's correct, Your Honor. If the court is inclined, despite the argument that FINRA has made, to go ahead and hear the merits of this question about the separate contractual right, I just want to address that briefly before I turn to the argument about the charter. If you look at the plain language of the settlement agreement, the paragraph that was negotiated talks about how NASD will indemnify you, and then there's some intermediate language that says, to the fullest extent permitted by law and NASD's organizational documents. Now, I know that the Amex's counsel has said that the semantics should not be controlling, but respectfully, so many opinions turn on words and how they are used. Here, this paragraph uses the word and, which is a conjunctive word, imposes two requirements, both of which need to be met. And you can construe this sentence in a way which will give effect to all the words of the sentence by using and. The organizational documents may, in fact, include provisions which ultimately are found not to be lawful. There have been opinions of this court and the Court of Chancery which analyze governing documents and say that aspect is not lawful. And so you could say, if you have to the fullest extent permitted by law and the organizational documents, you're giving effect to both by saying that portion of the organizational documents provisions which are permitted by the fullest extent permitted by law. By using the and, you're using both things. They both make sense. According to their argument, of course, first you would have to get past the word and being a word that is has the meaning of and instead disregard and use it as meaning or. Under their argument, you would essentially be assuming that there's no point to the words about the organizational documents, because if what was intended was the fullest extent permitted by law, then that sentence could end after that and not have any need for and NASD's organizational documents. Now, another argument the NASD makes, if you get past the plain language and you're considering what's the extrinsic evidence, the record shows that Mr. Sedano didn't bargain for and receive an independent right to indemnification separate from what's in the charter. In fact, there's not a single piece of evidence to support any such negotiating history. If you look at the evidence, the documents, Mr. Sedano's testimony, Mr. Raskin, his lawyer, the vice chancellor's statements in the brief, Mr. Sedano's brief, and even the Amex's brief, all focused on the NASD's organizational documents and not some separate contractual right. For example, at A1245 of the appendix, which is the Amex's pretrial brief, there's a statement talking about paragraph 4 of the settlement agreement. It says, and this is page 14 of their brief, the provision was added to the NASD-Sedano agreement, quote, to make clear that the NASD was continuing to indemnify Sedano to the fullest extent provided in and available under the NASD's organizational documents. So all along, the parties, the negotiating history, the opinion, everything was consistent. There was nothing anywhere, no testimony that anyone thought that they were negotiating some separate contractual right. So if I may, I'll turn now to the second argument, which is one where clearly they did have the right to take an appeal, and we're not arguing that they didn't preserve that right, which is, did Vice Chancellor Strying err in his interpretation of Article 5H? Now, just to remind you, if I may briefly, that provision says that the NASD's obligation, if any, to indemnify or advance expenses to any person who is or was serving at its request, and then it has the intermediate language about the entities, shall be reduced by any amount such person may collect as indemnification or advancement from the other entities. And when you look at what Vice Chancellor Strein had to say in his analysis of that, he concluded that the NASD, this is at page 5 of his opinion, the NASD's certificate provision creates a hierarchical obligation such that Sedano must first seek to collect from the Amex, and the NASD will only be responsible to the extent Sedano is unable to collect from the Amex. He goes on to say, that reading fits the language of the relevant provision and corresponds with the common sense notion that because the obligation arises in the first instance because of Sedano's exposure to covered proceedings as a result of his conduct at the Amex should be primarily liable for providing advancement for those proceedings. And, of course, stepping back, under Delaware law, as the Court knows, there's no obligation to provide any advancement or indemnification to someone who is serving at the request of the corporation. You then, therefore, have the ability, as this Court has acknowledged, if you undertake to provide something that you don't have an obligation to provide, you may do so subject to limitations or conditions that you impose. And that is exactly what was done here. There's no question, of course, that his conduct arose by reason of his service at the Amex. That was actually something that was conceded below by the Amex. So that is not something that has to be a question for this Court to review. And it really makes no sense if you think about it. You know, what would the purpose of this provision be? If you think about what it is that the Amex says, it would make no logical sense that FINRA and I should point out, as the Amex notes in its brief in a couple of places, you know, many, I think they even say thousands of companies have a charter provision like this, so this will obviously have significant implications beyond just this case. But if you think about what would motivate a company to put this in, they're saying that the only purpose it should have is to prevent a double recovery. It does seem odd that FINRA would have as its only concern and only rationale for putting in a paragraph avoiding a double recovery. It really doesn't affect FINRA if Mr. Sedano ends up getting a double recovery. If FINRA has an obligation that it has to pay, it still has to pay. So the fact that Mr. Sedano might get something twice is not a logical reason to put in a paragraph. No, the much more logical reason is the one that Vice Chancellor Strein found. There are some arguments that the MX makes about policy. They say that, oh, this would be very troublesome if the court upholds Vice Chancellor Strein's ruling as it contravenes public policy. They talk about how it will create burdens on indemnities. There was a statement that who knows what limitations there might be at the subsidiaries and what indemnification rights there might be. If those rights are not sufficient, obviously the person can come to FINRA and seek fees that way.
Well, what's your understanding of the current general practice between parents and subsidiaries? If a parent puts two or three directors on the subsidiary and the directors get sued on the subsidiary as a result of work on the subsidiary, is the advancement and indemnification by the subsidiary with the parent in a secondary position, or do they respond at the same time?
Your Honor, I apologize. I have to confess that I'm not aware of what the general practice is in that context. Another argument that the MX has made is that it's important for the court to issue court rulings that assist and not frustrate the policy in favor of advancement and indemnification. Well, FINRA is certainly not disputing that there are perhaps even dozens of cases from this court, the Court of Chancery, talking about how important it is to fulfill those policies. This isn't one of those cases. Mr. Sedano is going to be fully protected. His rights are not going to be frustrated. He, of course, obviously didn't appeal and isn't here before you. They also say that the court should not have entered an order on indemnification because the time has not yet come for a determination of whether Mr. Sedano met the standard of conduct, which Section 145 imposes. Actually, what Vice Chancellor Strein did is more subtle than what they're saying. Vice Chancellor Strein didn't purport to make some finding on whether Mr. Sedano was entitled to ultimate indemnification, and of course he couldn't because the underlying proceeding hadn't yet reached its conclusion. Now, he was simply making a ruling which had implications for the relative obligations or lack thereof between these two parties who might have obligations to Mr. Sedano, but he wasn't going ahead and saying Mr. Sedano was entitled to indemnification. And the many cases that talk about what you shouldn't do until a proceeding is over really go to ultimate entitlement, because obviously until you know what all the facts are, you shouldn't be making a duplicative action by trying to make some ruling about whether he has met the standard of conduct. There's also an argument that the MX has made that the NASD has somehow been inconsistent in its arguments about what the word meaning is, the words may collect. And if you look at all the evidence, yes, actually the cross-claim does say in a preamble to the cross-claim, it does say does collect. Later in that very same cross-claim, it does say may collect. In the briefs, in the interrogatory answers, in the argument with the court, and in these briefs, everywhere else, the NASD has been clear that what we're talking about is the Amex has a responsibility in the first instance. If the Amex is unable to fulfill its obligation, and its general counsel at the time at her deposition acknowledged, they're financially able to meet the obligation. But if they're not, that is when things kick in with the NASD. And so there is, and by the way, there's a citation to a portion of the argument with Vice Chancellor Strein where there's a suggestion that the NASD was suggesting that the interpretation was does collect. I won't take the court's time to go through that, but if you look at those portions, in fact, counsel to NASD never says any such thing and, in fact, points out that if you look at Amex's interpretation, it has permission to collect. I guess my final point, Your Honors, is they have asked as relief to have, it seems, in one place, this court go ahead and undertake some allocation between the parties. And we're not saying they couldn't make that argument to Vice Chancellor Strein below, but FINRA submits that in the event that the court is inclined to reverse, then that matter should be remanded to Vice Chancellor Strein. I see that my time is up.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
This case has very broad implications. It's not just about whether Mr. Sedano collects under Amex. The vice chancellor's decision is going to interpret a clause in corporate charters that's very commonly used. You correctly asked, Your Honor, about what's the experience. I'm not sure any of us here can tell you, because that was not tried, what the firms do or not do. But we can look at what the NASD did. We can look at what the parties here did in interpreting this clause. This matter, the argument they have made about a hierarchy of responsibility, was never raised when these events were going on. When the Alpert plaintiffs brought a lawsuit against Mr. Sedano, Mr. Ryan, the directors of the Amex, the NASD stepped right up to the plate and they paid. Now, they also knew how to write the clause with a hierarchy. If Your Honors look at the contract at page 8310, there's a medical provision in there, and it expressly says you must first go to the Amex to get your medical payments paid, then you can come to the NASD. So they knew how to write it if they wanted to, and they didn't do that in this case. And they also gave the Amex directors coverage when the Amex directors complained about it. Finally, the record is clear that there is no statement ever by them to anyone that they construed this clause this way or that they were limiting Mr. Sedano. My time is up, and I don't want to abuse that, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.